High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. Today's episode is sponsored by ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. Visit their website at isaac1.org, I-A-S-I-C-1.org, to follow the science on marijuana. Friends, fentanyl is plaguing America. There is no safe drug supply unless it comes from a legal pharmacy. If you are around anyone who may be using drugs, you should carry naloxone, the opioid reversal agent. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show, submit a question, or download a free prescription for naloxone. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a bridge conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. What's a bridge? Well, a bridge is a structure that takes you from one place over an obstacle to another place. A bridge is also a means of connection or transition, such as a bridge between cultures or a bridge from war to peace. In California, home of the Golden Gate Bridge, we have the California Bridge Program. This program uses emergency department as a bridge to get over the initial hump of opioid withdrawal and into addiction treatment. No one in America should ever feel the pains of opioid withdrawal. Sweating, tremors, body aches, stomach cramps, vomiting, diarrhea, anxiety. There's treatment for that. I'd also add that every hospital and clinic in our country should be able to treat and prevent opioid withdrawal. I would go further and say that every doctor's office should be able to treat simple opiate use disorder in the same way they treat uncomplicated cases of asthma, diabetes, or hypertension. Our government is spending billions on addiction treatment, and it should be available to everyone. I'm very proud that my emergency department is part of the California Bridge Program. Listen to episode number 6 with Robert on his journey from homelessness and multiple surgeries due to intravenous drug use and infection to being a straight A student in computer science. Last night, I treated a man who entered new transitional housing and was in withdrawal. He looked miserable, visibly ill. I reviewed his medical records and noted that he had a heart attack on a recent admission when he was high in methamphetamine. He looked so ill that I thought maybe he was having another heart attack right in front of me. He confessed that his drug of choice was fentanyl. Although he also used methamphetamine and alcohol, he was now withdrawing from fentanyl, and he last used 3 days ago. He told me he overdosed 6 times and started heroin at age 24. But I asked him, what age did you first start using drugs, any drugs? And he said 14 with marijuana. I gave him buprenorphine, the drug used to treat opiate use disorder, and he felt better. Luckily, he did not have a heart attack. And after buprenorphine, he looked and felt like a new man. I talked to him about addiction and how it hijacked his brain, and I warned him not to quit buprenorphine too early in treatment. His brain was primed on drugs since he was a young boy at 14, and resetting his brain dopamine receptors will take a year or maybe longer, a lifetime. Like diabetes, some people may need insulin for a short period of time until they lose weight, but others may need an insulin pump for the rest of their life. I sent my very happy emergency department patient home with a bridge prescription for buprenorphine, a prescription for naloxone, and a connection with our navigator. Our navigator professional, Tanya, will call him, make sure he gets an appointment with a clinic for addiction treatment. And with that, let's hear our question of the day.
Hi, Dr. Lev. It's so nice to work with you in the emergency department. I'm a charge nurse in the ED that is often overfilled with patients. We often have a full waiting room and patients in the hallways. We treat many people who have an opioid use disorder. I wonder, is there a way to use telemedicine for these patients instead of taking up precious emergency department bed space? Thank you.
Thank you, Chris, for your great question and your lovely English accent, and also for saving lives every day in a stressful and demanding emergency department in an inner city. I know you care very deeply about all our emergency department patients, including those who have a substance use disorder. You wonder, and sometimes I do too, whether the emergency department is the best place for this care. To answer your question, I invited one of the directors of the California Bridge Program to tell us about the program. Ariana Campbell is an emergency department physician assistant with more than 20 years of clinical experience. She works at the medical center at Placerville, California, and initiated an innovative program on treating opiate use disorder in her emergency department. She currently serves as the director and co-principal investigator for the California Bridge Program, dedicated to making 27 access to addiction treatment the standard of care in every hospital. To learn more about Ariana Campbell and the California Bridge Program, check out the High Truth show notes. Ariana Campbell, welcome to High Truths.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
I am happy to have you. And we're going to have a fun conversation because we both work in the emergency department and there's like an instant camaraderie between, you know, like nobody knows what we do. No one knows what we live through in the emergency department unless you're there. You just can't describe it. You can't even watch it on TV, right?
It's so true. I don't know if it's a trauma bond, a family bond, but yes, we're part of something.
Right. And to our audience, sometimes we laugh inappropriately. So just excuse us because it's just our way of coping with really serious stuff. Right. So we just kind of sometimes just have to laugh about it because it's better than crying. But Ariana, you have a special passion to treating patients with substance use disorder. You treat everything in the emergency department, you know, right? You just told me about a patient you treated who had word salad from having a stroke. You do everything, but you have a special, focus on substance use disorder. Why? Where did that come from? Usually, you're just like, ugh, another, person with drugs, like another alcoholic in the hallway. How did you change like that?
Well, it's a great question because I've been doing this a long time. So 23 years so far, and 17 years I actually spent not treating substance use disorders with the kind of care I treat people with now. And it didn't feel good. I always felt like maybe I was missing out on something, but I didn't know what that was. So there was a point when I changed, and I call it my self-reflective moment. So I live and work in a rural community. So I'm Northeastern California, and there was no addiction services in my entire county. And there's one primary care physician who got their X waiver, now gone, obsolete, but at the time, and was treating people with buprenorphine. And they came to me and said, "We're having trouble getting people in. We've heard that maybe some emergency departments can give better medication for this." And the first thing out of my mouth, Renee, was I said, "Yeah, we don't do that in the emergency department. This isn't the place for that." You know, right. we had all of these fears. And then I just heard myself talking, and I just took a moment and really considered what I was saying. And then I actually thought, what am I so proud of that I'm doing right now? And I work and live in a small community, I said. So I would see some people that I had handed this list to. Go pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get help. That's what you need. And I knew it wasn't working out for them. And when I made that change, as soon as I started giving the right medication at the right time to the right patient, it just all made sense. And I thought, wow, there's so much more that I can do. And it changed the course of my practice. It made me feel a lot better about what I do for a living. And it really changed my career. And it's created a huge culture change in my emergency department as well.
Is it more personal because you're in a rural community? Like, you know, these people, they could be your neighbors or your friends or your family.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, what's funny is recently, I told you I would see some people in the community and who I'd handed the list to, and you can tell things aren't going well. And I recently had somebody that I treated, and I wasn't sure, they were struggling a lot. And, we don't always get follow-up in the emergency department. So I wasn't sure how it was going. And then I literally bumped
into. And sometimes we get a lot of follow-up, right? There is Alex again.
Yep, for the wrong reasons. And so, but this person I bumped into in the freezer section at the store, and they looked great. And their skin looked good. They were going to buy food. And I just thought, I wonder if they're still in treatment. So I checked in and they were still in treatment. And I had started them, you know, previously when things weren't going as well. So I have to say it's an honor. It's an honor to be able to do the right thing on a regular basis for people in my rural community, for sure.
That's nice. California Bridge. Can you tell us what is the California Bridge program? I gave my audience a little bit of introduction and I told them how I'm proud of being a Bridge hospital and gave them an example, but let's hear it from the person who's running the program.
Well, I told you about my journey in the very beginning where I started giving buprenorphine, and then I met with others who had started doing this in their emergency departments. And this was in 2017, Dr. Andrew Herring, Amy Moulin, and Hannah Snyder. And we all got together, and for us, it was obvious that we needed, everybody should be doing this. This is so, it wasn't very hard. It was the right thing to do, and it was saving lives. So we started literally, Renee, we started cold calling people and saying, hey, you should be doing this because it's really important and you'll save lives. And it's really good for your community. And it's funny because some people, of course, told me I was crazy. It's a practice change, right? So practice change sometimes is met with open arms and other times it's met with some reluctance, of course, all of which we expected. But we were able to get some people to start doing it, and they felt the same way. So we started Bridge kind of in that scrappy way of just trying to do the right thing for people. And then it ballooned, and we set really, really high goals. So we knew, you know, average time it takes to make a practice change is 17 years. We know in the next decade, more than 1 million people may die from overdoses. So it's all unacceptable. So how can we make this change? Because the medicine that we know works, we know it doubles a person's likelihood of being in treatment in a month. And that treatment reduces, like cuts that person's risk of dying in half, right? So we wanted to get that medication out there. So then we utilized grant funding to give to hospitals to establish navigators, because we all work in emergency departments. We know it's really crazy, really busy, and the system's not perfect. So what can we do to make this easy? And we knew that that was actually putting navigators at hospitals. So we took 52 hospitals and we funded navigators.
So tell us what a navigator is.
Oh yeah, thank you. So we call them a substance use navigator. Now we call them bridge navigators, but they're navigators who, you know, because you might think, actually, why are we not using social workers or case managers? That's what we're used to in emergency departments. But navigators are different. Many of them have lived history, though not required. They have to be really just very, very passionate about helping people who use drugs get better care.
I call and them peer support.
Yeah, peer support. They can be peers. We don't want to put peers necessarily in their name because they're working professionals, and they can identify that if they have their own lived history or not. But a big part of this is actually them, number one, being a friendly face in the emergency department, recognizing that there's a lot of people who do avoid emergency departments. Maybe it hasn't gone well for them in the past. People have been mistreated in emergency departments. I mean, I know that. I know I was part of a system that was not treating people who use drugs in a great way, and we're changing that. And so our navigators have gone into emergency departments. They're definitely a friendly face. They know of all, you know, they can bring all of the different resources in the community to the one person who needs it in the emergency department, and have, you know, a lot of information about ways to connect people to care. And really the idea is rapid, low barrier, low threshold access. Somebody can just come into the emergency department 24/7, get evidence-based care, so get medication that works, and get connected to resources in the community that they may not know exist, and including follow-up. Most of our patients are able to follow up very quickly. My patients typically are following up the next business day.
And oh my God, we're getting 2 weeks. You're doing great.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's usually the next business day, but we're a lot more comfortable with prescribing buprenorphine now. So it can be up to a week. We just make it easy for patients. I have found when they follow up pretty quickly, I want my patients to feel wrapped around in a system of care. It's just like,
but are you getting a clinic appointment within the next day? You have next day appointments at clinics?
Yeah, we actually built that into our system. So we have standing 9 a.m. appointments, and it started at one clinic. And then now we have that standing 9 a.m. appointment at two clinics, but we have connections with four clinics in the community. So we actually give our patients choices on where they can go.
Very nice. I love that. But why the emergency department? And like the place is busy, right? We're getting stroke codes. We're getting traumas. COVID kind of changed things about, but we're now back to same volume. Do we need more patients to come here for, why the ER? Why was this, except for all of you guys who had this idea, where emergency sure. work?
Well, our patients are already there. I mean, to answer that question, our patients are already there. Frequently coming in for reasons may not be disclosing to us that they're using drugs, because if they don't feel safe disclosing or feel like they're going to be judged or treated poorly, they may not necessarily disclose that to us. So we actually, part of our bridge program, you know, I told you we started with kind of scrappy. We built 52 hospitals. And with those first 52 hospitals, all of them were able to start giving buprenorphine. And we had this great shared experience that this actually made this part of medicine easier. So we give a medication sometems in triage, you know, in the waiting room. It's a sublingual medication. So where we may have been starting IVs for abdominal pain or for pain before, our first 52 hospitals, we figured out we should put signage in the emergency department so people know we're doing this and can disclose their substance use disorder. And so that created this great change where people have started telling us so we can treat them actually in right up front. You know, I love it when people tell me in triage what's wrong with them. It makes my job so much easier so I can provide the right care. And that's what happened. We know that 1 in 4 people have a substance use disorder who are in our emergency departments. So I think it's really important to recognize in light of this increasing epidemic, increasing overdose deaths, largely in people under the age of 45, most of whom I am not finding are able to make an appointment in a clinic in 3 months and keep it, that at any one time they may be coming into my emergency department and I can wrap them in care. And that care can completely change their life. I mean, I just had a patient like this who came in with dental pain and swelling. And I noticed that, you know, I noticed some signs that perhaps they were struggling with opioids, and offered harm reduction treatment. And the person just said, yeah, that actually sounds good. I think things aren't going well. I think I'm interested in getting into treatment. And they followed up the next day. So, and they didn't come in to be treated. So if we're going to, we need to increase capacity, right? We know that, I think it's 87% of people are not receiving treatment that need treatment. And we have to figure out ways to get to people so that they know that there is treatment, that they know that treatment works. And this is an opportunity to get to people, to be able to give them that treatment in a place where we know that 1 in 4 will screen positive for a substance use disorder.
And I agree with you that the patients are already there, right? We have people come in not with one complaint, right? That's the whole beauty and art of emergency medicine. People come in with a headache and they end up having appendicitis, right? I mean, it's nothing is textbook. And while getting a history, a social history, I always ask about drug use, and then you're able to have that conversation and going from, I call it, from being a good emergency physician to a great one, a great provider by providing that care. They're already there. But we also have, and I don't know if it's that way in Placerville or your other hospitals, patients being sent to the emergency department to get this care because we're available and the clinics aren't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that was actually a patient we saw yesterday, of course. So yes, that's what we do. And we're there all the time, and we've developed our own expertise in this. We've been doing this in my department now for 6 years. I had a PA who's in her first year actually out of school. And yesterday, you know, I I don't think they've all developed their own expertise. I had somebody who came over for treatment and, do you need some help? Oh, no, this is easy. I got it, you know, and was able to give a prescription and really understand when to start the medication. It's not rocket science. So I think having that available 24/7, I really do feel with so many people I've treated, there is a moment. There is a moment when somebody says, I'm ready for treatment. And if the system does not support the person in the moment, sometimes we lose people for a year or two because they just think it's too hard. And so if we can really create this path where it's like frictionless access, so like the clinic is closing, they don't have an appointment, but if you go to the emergency department right now, they can get you started and we'll see you back here. And yeah. Know that that system is going to work and that person is wrapped in that care that I talked about, it just makes a huge difference.
And the emergency department is a safety net. We're the safety net for society's problems, period. Whether it's mental health or homelessness or COVID or substance use disorder, we're the safety net and we provide those solutions to our community, whatever problems and new problems will happen over time and we're there to provide that. And this is the problem of our day. And we should be stepping up to be that safety net. And how many emergency departments are, is this available throughout California?
Yeah. So I started talking about how we were building it. We needed to create the wave. We need all of our friends to be doing this just so that we have this community of practice, this, you know, create this wave of people doing it. So we started those first 52 hospitals. Then we were able to get funding for navigators at another 150, right? So that was about a year ago. We were up to 200 hospitals out of 300 who really could implement this program, right, in California. Well, now we have 282 hospitals in California that are officially signed up with the Bridge program, have navigators, and are at some point in the spectrum of giving buprenorphine. So we've been able to do this in almost every hospital in California. I think we're at 95%. And our experience, I mean, so often people think this is a different kind of medicine or not in our wheelhouse. And it really is. I mean, this is our opportunity in emergency medicine to really, we are that safety net, to own that safety net. Mm-hmm. We have the opportunity to turn around an entire epidemic based on creating that, like increasing that capacity to see a lot of folks who don't know where to go. I mean, I do talk about, you know, how I started this out, Renee, with, you know, initially I went to a meeting, but my sister died from the effects of drugs.
I'm so sorry.
42. And when I talk about it, I know that the only place that she was going in the last couple of years of her life was the emergency department. Why? She was living in more chaotic times during those times. And I know that if she had an opportunity to change her life, if she had a navigator, perhaps who had talked to her, that would have just given her a chance, you know, because that's the only place that she was regularly seeking care, because it's open, because it's on the bus route, because it's available, it's the safety net, it's the place you don't have to have the right.
And not only that, when I did research called the Death Diaries, looking at everybody who died of prescription drugs and their medicines before they had, and I looking at that. I realize before someone dies, chances are they're going to the ER. That's an opportunity to make a prevention, to make an intervention.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's not hard, right? We've learned how to treat. It's way harder to treat diabetes or asthma or COVID than it is to treat and to prevent opiate withdrawals or to start someone on treatment for opiate withdrawals.
And people say, well, I just don't know what to say. I don't know how to start the conversation. And you touched on this, actually. You know how I start my conversations is I just ask permission. I say, is it okay if I talk to you about alcohol, drugs? And nobody's declined me yet.
Right. That's people, true. If you ask permission, they say, you know, is it okay if I ask? I used to say it for marijuana. I see kids on marijuana. I was like, is it okay if I talk to you about that? And sometimes they'll like, okay. And then I ask them, how was that? Did I offend you? And it's like, they were like, no, that's okay. I may even stop.
Yeah. And I think that's it. You know, it's so often it's that connection part. and building trust in medicine. And what I've noticed is now, like I said, we're the only place you can come. You don't have to have the right insurance card, ID. I always say no shirt, no shoes. We will take care of you. And so creating that open path for people where it's identifiable, you know, there's an H on the highway that identifies where the hospitals are. So making it that easy and then having a plan, just having a plan. So somebody comes in here with withdrawal, knowing I know the right medicine that's going to help them, just like I know the right medicine for asthma or COVID or, you know, whatever it may be. I know how to do this. And I actually have something that works better. I mean, the risk of somebody dying in the first year after a non-fatal overdose is really similar to a heart attack. And the difference is with a heart attack, you know, people are 70, 80 years old. In this case, younger than 45, many of them are in their 20s and 30s and are at a much higher risk of dying in the next year. But when we can give the right medication at the right time, it has enormous impact. I mean, we give naloxone out in our community. I know most of our bridge hospitals, I'm sure you do too, where we hand out naloxone, we distribute it. And when we do that, we offer medication treatment. And when people aren't there or they're using other substances and we want to keep them safe, we can put naloxone in their hands. And in my own community, we track this. And we had, of course, we have fentanyl in our community, and that's really all people can find. We've had a lot of overdoses, an unacceptable number, but we would have, by our count, had more than twice that had we not been handing out the naloxone we did, because we had more than the number of overdoses. We had known reversals from the naloxone we handed out. And I think that's important to know, just in that, in the whole spectrum of what we can do for people who use drugs in emergency departments, there's multiple things, and all of it has a lot to do with decreasing the amount of people who are dying in your community. So it's just important to recognize that this is emergency medicine. This is, you know, this is an overdose epidemic. And by definition, by treatment pathways, overdoses come to our emergency departments. And so I actually created, we have sepsis bundles. We have also, you know, we have all of our stroke pathways. I came up with an overdose bundle. You know, these are the things that we need to do for overdoses. So
for overdoses, and I would expand it. It's like, again, when I looked at people who died from medications, it's opioids, but also methamphetamines, also marijuana, also, you know, prescription drugs of opioids and benzodiazepine combinations. Yeah. Each time chances are we see someone in the emergency room before they die. And that is a chance to do prevention, to make sure they don't die. And opiate use disorder is one subset of that, I think, you know, alcohol, tobacco, other things as well. Right? If I have an older person who falls down, right? The number one, most people don't know this, the number one cause of visiting an emergency department, trauma center, right? When I started out my life, it would be the knife and gun club, and then it turned into motor vehicle collisions. Now it's elderly falls. That's the number one thing. So knowing that, we have a duty in prevention. We need to teach people how not to fall. So when I talk to people who fall and they broke their hip, I also talk to them about, well, what do we do next time to make sure you don't fall down? Like, what do we do? What can you do to think about that? And the same thing for alcohol, drugs, substance use disorder. Like, each person who's using, for even if that's not their chief complaint, there's an opportunity for you to say something as an emergency provider to possibly motivate them to change and make healthier choices or get treatment if they need it.
Yeah, it's funny. My navigator the other day, my substance use navigator, is just walking through the department, and she was wearing a t-shirt that said, "You can talk to me about alcohol and drugs." And somebody said, "Hey, I like your t-shirt." And she thought they were just complimenting her on her t-shirt. And they said, "Can I come out? Can I talk to you outside?" She forgot that the back of her t-shirt said, "You can talk to me about alcohol and drugs." But, you know, somebody was coming there for a different reason and was able to find help. So yeah, I think it's important. I mean, for anybody I'm discharging home after a fall, I'm talking to them about, do you live alone? We're talking about risks. Sometimes I have to get physical therapy or occupational therapy involved. And so when we just put it into the same light, it totally makes sense. And I always say that was where my thinking changed. So my thinking before was that this is somebody else's job, that somebody else is taking care of this, that substance use disorders are not what we do here. But all I had to do was just open the door to one thing. And to your point, I treat alcohol use disorder with evidence-based treatment. I offer medications to decrease craving for stimulant use disorder, methamphetamine, cocaine use. I offer pathways for people to get treatment and harm reduction. And it just all makes sense. Right. And I find that people, I had one gentleman who I was seeing him very frequently for abscesses related to injection drug use. And he wasn't ready to quit, but we talked about what was going on and ways that he could make a difference in order to decrease his risk of abscesses. And it's funny because I saw him a year later, not even as a patient. I just ran into him in the hospital and he said, "You haven't seen me because I cut back. I'm not injecting anymore." And he was really proud of it. And he got a job and was in a much more functional place in his life. And he thanked me for having that conversation. And this is just a conversation while I was doing a procedure, right? This didn't take any time or effort.
Those conversations, you know what, you're in the emergency department, we're treating people at the lowest of their health time. And that time is very impactful. So I go even upstream from that. So when I get my social history and say, "Do you smoke, drink, or use drugs?" I don't care what age. If somebody's drinking alcohol, older people, right? They're, "Oh yeah, I have a glass." I ask, "Well, how much are you drinking?" And I'll just say, dietary guidelines for alcohol means that you're an at-risk drinker. You don't necessarily have an alcohol use disorder, but you're using more than the recommended, you know, 4 at a time and 14 right. per week as a man, or 3 at a time and more than 7 for a woman, and the age difference, you know. So I make that intervention. If I see someone using marijuana, I said, "You know what, I ask permission and say, is it okay if I tell you about, you know, your brain growth and the risks of that?" So I think that that's important for both ends, you know, at that whole continuum. Because I think we do have a prevention role and we have a treatment role in the emergency department. And have you been able to show, as the California Bridge Program, have been able to show with data that this is making a difference?
That's a great question. There's confounders, right? So we have more than 200,000 visits from navigators, and this has been building over the last few years. And you know, initially in my community, we saw a decrease in overdose deaths, and that was right up until fentanyl came here. So we do think, you know, we've identified opioid use disorder, and we're almost up to 160,000 patients. So large volume in California where we're able to identify people, and we provided more than 71,000 prescriptions of buprenorphine. And hey, if you want to get naloxone out there, we gave out almost 130,000 naloxone kits in the last couple of years through emergency departments. So we know this is making a difference. We're tracking how many people we're treating, how many people are following up as well. I know that I have an 80% follow-up rate. More than half of those stay in treatment in 1 year. But it's hard to, you know, so yes, we do think we're having an enormous effect. We have volume. We have seen increased overdose deaths in California, just like other states, but we also have an enormous amount of people in California. So, you know, we're really looking at how to continue like increasing buprenorphine, but I can tell you it's not enough because we're still seeing increased overdose deaths.
Well, because not all of those people have a substance use disorder who are dying, right? Some people are one-time user, an occasional user. They don't need buprenorphine, right? They took a Xanax pill and dropped dead. That's why the upstream prevention is so important. That explains it. So we can't buprenorphine our way out of the fentanyl epidemic. But it's still an important role, right? And I think the way that you're measuring number of connection to treatment and a year afterwards, still in treatment, I think that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And those are folks with opioid use disorder. But recognizing that, we knew that, we're seeing, there's fentanyl in the drug supply. There's, you know, fentanyl poisoning, of course. And so, I locally reached out to my school superintendent, and we were able to work on getting naloxone into every school in my rural community, just knowing that that this was a risk. And so I think it's important to look at it from all those different angles and just getting the right kind of education out there too. Because there's a lot of course, there's a lot of scary stuff right now, But taking it from a perspective of, you know, just making sure we're educating people on the right thing, making sure, you know, I heard you talking a lot about naloxone access, making sure we're flooding the community with naloxone. All of those things are really important and really getting that education out there. I have four teenagers and we talk about this all the time. These are regular conversations we have, knowing, you know, the drug supply is of course different right now than it was even 5 years ago. So,
yeah. So I thought, I don't know if it's 5-6 years ago, he said naloxone needs to be over the counter and we need to make it readily available. And when it wasn't, I just put free prescription on my website. Anybody could download it. I don't care. It should be over the counter. I like dare the DEA to come after me. But it should be available. So I hope people have accessed that, and hopefully you don't need to, that it's just, you know, people should be able to just go to your grocery store and get it.
Yeah, it should be that easy, because yes, we give it out from the emergency department to everybody that we can, to, you know, anybody who asks for it. It's no questions, actually. You can just, we post it all over my emergency department that we have free naloxone. And mm-hmm. It should be that easy, but people also shouldn't have to always come into the emergency department to get it. So having it free and
right. easy. You should be able to get it at your CVS or Walgreens, exactly. Right?
Yeah.
Without asking. So Chris Matthews, he's one of our charge nurses in the emergency department, and he has a great question. He has compassion. People have a substance disorder, but he wonders, and sometimes I do too, is this the place for just starting induction for people who have an opiate use disorder? So we have people who know that there's not resources in the community. We're the safety net in the emergency department. And so all of a sudden at the peak hours, our emergency department is hopping, our hallways are full, the waiting room is crazy. And in comes the bus from, you know, different rehab centers with the group of patients needing to get their meds. They need medication refills, which is not easy. That's complicated. And then they want to get started on buprenorphine, and we're there for them, but I'm wondering, is this the best way? And can we use telehealth instead?
That's a great question. So actually a lot of us have landed in that telehealth world because we're trying to create frictionless access to treatment. And I do have to acknowledge not everybody wants to come to the emergency department. So, you know, so that's why actually one of the other reasons we have navigators, because my navigator will talk to you regardless of if you've come into my emergency department or not, just to help you navigate what is a very complex question or a very complex system, excuse me. So, hey, we wouldn't need navigators. We wouldn't need the emergency department necessarily as this open door if this system was so easy to access. But I know that I see a lot of people with upper respiratory infections because their doc can't see them for 3 weeks, right? So it's important for all emergency departments to offer evidence-based treatment, but it needs to be a system of care, and that system has to include a telehealth option. So I actually have been working just per diem intermittently in an FQHC in a federally qualified health center that it has primary care physicians who are giving buprenorphine and providing substance use disorder treatment. I'm now going to start working in a rural health facility who does the same thing. And what is key to all of this is a telehealth option, because in my town, there's, 45 minutes away, you know, it can take people a long, long time to get to the emergency department, right? Like a clinic I'm going to work in is just 15 or 20 miles, but takes 45 minutes because of windy roads. So I have trouble sometimes getting to appointments. So it's really important to have a telehealth option. And a lot of this medicine, there's people who have been on medication for quite some time, are very, very stable and are working 8 to 5, you know, who have very busy lives. So it's really important to have telehealth. And I wish I had telehealth from my emergency department to really create that frictionless access so that I could offer that option to people who aren't able to make it in. But I do think that, you know, on this ongoing basis, I have found that when telehealth is combined with some sort of brick and mortar institution, it seems to work really well, because there are some people who just do a lot better as well if they can make connection, like, you know, really connect with a clinician as well.
So, you know, when COVID hit, the emergency departments emptied out, right? People were afraid of coming to the ER. But the people who did come were coming in from the different rehab facilities to get their buprenorphine and their medications. And I thought, you know what, really, we're exposing these people to COVID. At that point, we didn't know. We were scared. There was no vaccines. And at that, at some point, we didn't even have masks, if you remember back then. I thought, why don't we just do telehealth to these people? Why are we bringing them into the ER? Why don't I come to you, to wherever you are in your wherever facility you're in and you need to get started on medications, and even jails, why don't we just do that for you 24/7 from the emergency department, but without coming in? You know, we can do that. And a lot of my great ideas get shut down. This was shut down because, well, if they come in person, then you have the EMTALA federal obligation to treat them without payment, without money. But if you do telehealth, then you need money.
Yes. So yes, I tried to tried to do this in my own emergency department, and it was challenging because of some of the regulations out there, but it made a lot of sense because we were just trying to help people, you know. And I also knew that a lot of places were shutting their doors, you know, at the moment. It was a scary time, and we're the safety net. I was there ready to see people, happy to take care of people. And when you look at a lot of the graphs, you know, we track data, we saw a lot of people who did not get treatment during that time. And that's when we saw fentanyl come into California right around the same time. So this surging overdose deaths, what an important time for us to have open doors and telehealth options open. And one of my partners in this, Amy Moulin, was able to come up with a system actually through her emergency department for telemedicine that was very successful. And it's very important. In fact, with the state of emergency ending, we're really concerned about telemedicine options being, you know, continuing to be available, because having different, a lot of people need different ways of seeking treatment. We need to create easy avenues for people to access treatment. And, you know, I have some people, you know, some people who don't have any housing, they don't have any transportation to come see me. And so, you know, for those folks, when I'm working in the FQHC, I'm able to talk to them on the phone, see them on a video, assess them, and make sure I get them medication to continue their treatment in what are really trying times sometimes. So it's an incredibly important option.
And shout out to Dr. Amy Moulin, because if she was able to do that with telehealth and doing a lot of innovative things, she's wonderful. And maybe this is something that California Bridge can help out, because I see the Bridge program as a lot more than a bridge, right? Now that we got rid of the X waiver, there's a whole community of primary care physicians that need to learn how to treat opiate use disorder, and they can do it. They've learned how to treat COVID, and they learned how to treat diabetes and hypertension and asthma and way more complicated things. They could take this on, and California Bridge could be a teacher for that. And the telehealth options, I think long-term, we have to protect our safety net in the emergency department. We have to be, you know, of available for emergencies, and I see us going down the path now with sad outcomes. When the place is full, I have a very good friend who died in the waiting room with chest pain because all the beds were full. And he had an EKG with abnormalities, but they were like, let's wait for a bed, let's wait for a bed. And there was no bed, and he died because our beds were full with not all necessarily emergencies. People were waiting for, you know, placement or mental health issues or even substance use disorder. So I feel like as a society, we have a duty to protect our safety net. We're there for you. We need to be. And substance use disorder and fentanyl is the problem of our country right now. But we also have to think long term. And I think telehealth and teaching that and figuring out ways to make that happen is one thing.
Oh, absolutely. So many times I feel like everybody needs a friend in medicine, and that friend in medicine is telehealth is a really good option sometimes, right? Some people just need some reassurance. And it's, you know, having that combination though, the ability to have a system of care, right? That's what I think is really important, a system of care. So having that safety net connected to telehealth so that this is this integrated system, because I think through a patient's eyes, you know, I just had somebody who was sent in from telehealth last night, and, you know, you can't see everything on a camera. So sometimes they need somebody to lay eyes on them, and having an integrated system makes a lot more sense and would
You know, I was thinking if every detox center in the country, you have people there taking for them. They don't, you know, they just need to take vital signs, right? And you'd have somebody there taking vital signs. You could take the cow's score of, you know, seeing how bad the withdrawal is and prescribe through telehealth. And we would be able to provide 24/7 treatment without taking up emergency department resources to all these facilities.
That's exactly it. Because it's not rocket science. This is not difficult medicine. In fact, more often now than ever, we're giving people prescriptions to start at home. So it's, and people are doing just fine. We sometimes give them supportive medications until they're in enough withdrawal to take the buprenorphine. Many times it's a prescription that they start. They do start the medication. Again, I've maintained more than 80% follow-up rate most of the times, at times 90% follow-up rate. So wow. People are coming in for treatment, right? So being able to do that through telehealth, also having that safety net though, having the emergency department with expertise in treating withdrawal, opioid withdrawal. At the same time, you know, you mentioned mental health. So many people, it's not just one thing. So many people are in crisis and it may be that they're suffering from, you know, depression, suicidality, alcohol use disorder, opioid use disorder, and having the ability to address that all in one place, because it's one human being who has all of that. Being able to take care of things a lot earlier through telehealth so that it doesn't end up in so much crisis, but having that system of care that will really take care of somebody and that communicates and that has different options that work for different people, it's incredibly important. It's right. Part of, we keep talking about the system of care, really innovating the system of care to meet the needs of people. And, you know, we're trying to change the world. We're trying to change medicine, but yeah. It makes sense if you really think about it from a patient's perspective.
Right. We have gaps. The emergency department's there to fill the gaps, and we definitely have a lot of work to do. But I like California Bridge because you're working so much more than just opioids and buprenorphine, right? I've seen on the website guidelines for alcohol withdrawal management. Hopefully you'll get into the issue of methamphetamine, which is a terrible, health hazard in California and the West and going across the country, and even marijuana.
Yeah, we actually, this is a natural place for us to land. So we do have a guide for methamphetamine that should be coming out soon. And I do things for methamphetamine in my emergency department. So often I hear from people, okay, it's not opioids, it's meth. And it's different. We certainly don't have a buprenorphine for meth, but having the ability to talk to people, I have so many people I sit down and talk to who are in crisis, they're experiencing a lot of agitation, and I offer them a way to get healthier. And many times when I just sit down and I'm kind and offer some help, they cry because, you know, nobody's been looking them in the eye, sitting down and talking to them and offering them some options. So I actually have a whole system that I do for methamphetamine, and our follow-up rate was not the same. I think we were at like 30 or 40%.
What do you do for patients with methamphetamine?
So I offer medication. There's a couple of different evidence-based medications that help. The evidence isn't as strong as buprenorphine.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them evidence-based yet.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not nowhere near as strong as buprenorphine for opioid use disorder, but there's some scientific literature out there. That's what I'll say. And so I have, most recently I gave somebody who had been on bupropion and naltrexone in the past, I gave them that and gave them olanzapine as needed for agitation. And if they had any, if they were experiencing any psychosis, any hints of like, if they were just seeing or feeling things that other people weren't, I would give them some olanzapine to kind of, it's, you know, we call it a chill pack, but I refer to care because the most evidence, when we look at all of the literature, what works the best seems to be contingency management. So I have made connections with my outpatient partners, my clinics, and they're offering contingency management right now for methamphetamine.
And that's important. I think what we can do is we are connecting patients with opiate use disorder. Why aren't we connecting patients with methamphetamine use disorder or even marijuana use disorder? I had a person email my HiTruth website and said, you know what, I have to keep my marijuana addiction secret because of my employment. But where do I get help for marijuana use? I can't stop. And I, you know, that's a tough question. And I just had to like say, you know, first of all, it's legitimate. It's you. Marijuana is an addiction. Two, withdrawal from marijuana is real. So no wonder you're having trouble, because you would you'll feel anxiety, headache, insomnia. That is symptoms of marijuana, which withdrawal different than alcohol or methamphetamine. Methamphetamine withdrawal is easiest. You just crash. It makes it easy. I mean, opioid withdrawal is very, you know, painful. I was saying, you know, maybe follow some of the same things that we're doing for tobacco cessation and apply it for marijuana. But that's a real problem too. And I don't know if California Bridge is steering away from that, because I know marijuana, we're in California, it's controversial, but every single day, and Ariana, I bet you do too, every single day you're treating marijuana poisoning. Cannabis-induced psychosis, cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, drug interactions from marijuana. I bet you, you know, you see that too.
So much suffering. That's all I have to say, is I see so much suffering. And, obviously we've all seen this increase. You know, I've been in medicine a long time and seen this increase. And we actually do refer people who are struggling with marijuana. So it's having that person-centered approach, I think, because it's wonderful. We've cultivated relationships. So the clinic actually across the street from my hospital, we call it a bridge clinic. And really it just means it's like, there's a clinic, I talked to a person in Canada and they call it rapid access addiction medicine. And that's really what it is. It's this contiguous, you know, we offer this clinic across the street that has open access. They will see you for tobacco use. They will see you for marijuana use. They will see you for methamphetamine use, opioid use, alcohol use disorders, all of these, you know, and they're starting to look at if we can provide better care for HIV, hepatitis C in this rural community, right, where there's no access. But it's this open door between the clinic, the emergency department and hospital. And then we have this navigator in between. And because we see people, to your point, who every day are struggling with and suffering from the effects of marijuana, it just makes sense to have this contiguous, you know, this connection to a clinic, and where we can have people follow up and meet their goals. And I do meet people all the time who are suffering from, you know, they are withdrawing from marijuana. They are experiencing marijuana use disorder. They're trying to get their lives back. And we, by being prepared, like I said, you know, making sure we have all these connections to our community and know the different resources available, we can always meet people where they're at and provide them the best, you know, the best care. So it's all.
It's all important. And I'm wondering, with the work that you do, the suffering that you see, you're a mom of teenagers. What do you tell them?
Oh my gosh, those are tricky conversations, because to them, I'm just mom. So what I've done, this was really, you know, we started talking about this at a really early age, and I really wanted just to be open to their experience as well. And I think what I've had to learn as a mom is also to recognize my kids' experience, listen to them, provide some insight. And if they do ask me questions, I am ready to answer, but I have to do a lot of listening. So that's where things change. I mean, I listen to my patients in the emergency department, and I think I had a tendency to try to just like give all this information to my kids, because
as ER docs, right? Do it next, right?
Just like fix everything. Right. And so I definitely had, you know, I had to take a listening approach. And I do have to tell you a story about this, because I went to talk to the teachers at the school, because what I realized is I don't think we've been talking to our teachers about what's going on in addiction medicine. And so the teachers were still kind of going with the Just Say No DARE programs, you know, and I know there's been some innovations but
we still say we just use Just Say No, but it's KNOW.
Yes, exactly. Just say, yeah. So there's innovation. So just say KNOW. But I took that to heart, and I went and did a presentation for the teachers at the school. And I showed them a video of just one of the patient stories from our bridge program. And what's funny is my kids, who probably roll their eyes at me all the time, but they told me that their teacher played this video to show that there's hope. And they, somebody raised their hand. One of the teachers raised their hand. They said, okay, so if it's not Just Say No, and if it's not, it can't be all punitive. What is it? What is it with the kids? And I said, you know, it's human connection. So kids are suffering. There's a lot of kids who have trauma, bad experiences. There's familial patterns sometimes in drug use. And it's being open, offering hope and resources and knowing what those resources are. And I give them the phone number for our navigator. You know, we have connections now with a counselor at the schools. They've started doing a program when kids are caught with drugs, where they will do, instead of just all punitive, you're now suspended from school, they'll do counseling with this counselor who has a lot of knowledge about drugs. And it's changing things. It's changing culture. And then they were very open to having naloxone in the schools. And so I think it's just sharing that education and then having teachers all on board. So it's like an entire community of people with this shared understanding of how we can get through this together. And that is important. We're trying to cultivate that all over California through navigators. We have emergency department champions and hospital champions across California. So we have, ER docs and PAs, and we have nurses who are doing this work. And we're doing a lot of, we're doing a lot of bridge building. We're doing this community of practice to create leaders who will go out into their communities and do these same things. I've talked to my city council, and it's just changing culture so that we have care for people who use drugs rather than judgment and stigma.
Right. And that's all important on the continuum of people who have a substance use disorder. They deserve treatment with compassion and no stigma. In approaching kids, I realized, and I'm learning from my podcast, from the experts who come here, about prevention science and social norms. And so actually, most kids don't use fentanyl. And a lot of kids don't use marijuana, and promoting those social norms. So there's a sub-segment of people when you go to a school who are not using drugs. They're not using marijuana or alcohol. And actually, what's really encouraging, if you look at the NISDA data that looks at and monitoring the future data that looks at teenage and young adult use, more people now than ever at 12th graders, don't use any drugs, not alcohol, not marijuana, not tobacco, nothing. And that percentage is increasing. So talking to that population, the job is saying, good job. That's a social norm. You're protecting your brain, and your job is to protect your brain and fill it with all sorts of good things until you're 25 years old. And then there's another population that's, is curious. Maybe you want to, we call it experiment. I say experiment, but Dr. Nora Wolkoff corrected me and said people who occasionally misuse. And that education needs to know that fentanyl is out there in absolutely everything, and there is no safe drug supply unless you get it from a pharmacy with a prescription with your name on it. And then there's a patient population that we typically see in the emergency department where California bridges in, people who have a substance use disorder that's connecting them to treatment. But we actually see all that in the emergency department. So I apply those prevention lessons to whatever population that I see. And anyways, I just wanted to throw that out there.
I'm currently getting my master's in public health from Johns Hopkins. And so I just studied all of this, and it's really eye-opening to see, because there is that just like encouragement for people who continue to say, I'm not using anything. There's different people, as it turns out, and this is society in general, different people need different things at different times in their life. And I think so important to recognize.
Right. And if you take a bunch of kids and say, hey, here's some, fentanyl strips and naloxone, they'll be like, what are you talking about? Right. And it's ridiculous. It's just as it's ridiculous to say somebody who, intravenous drug user who's there for you, you're opening their abscesses and you're like, well, why don't you just quit? That's so easy.
Yeah. And so I think for me, when I say listening to my kids, because they're all different, right? They have different personalities. So, listening to where they're at, answering their questions, and trying to be open. But do I have the conversation that there is no safe pill out there? Absolutely. Because I think that's, of course, as a parent, that's what you're so concerned about, is those natural, experimental tendencies. I think, we know that that's pretty common in teenagers and not safe, right? So, there's a different drug supply. So I think getting that information out there has been important. All of us parents talk about that, but then taking those kids, and you're right, it's not just that one thing that fit, not one size doesn't fit all, right? And it's the same thing for different substances. So finding what works for opioid use disorder, where we have great evidence, there's different things for different substances. And then even within that, there's complexity because some people do have co-occurring mental health problems that need to be addressed. And so again, just having the ability to connect folks, it's not rocket science. It's just doing the right thing for people. You know, yeah, people have diabetes, hypertension, coronary artery disease, and have some complexity, but we know the things that work. And I think it's really looking at treating substance use disorders through that same lens where there's lots of things that we can do to promote health and wellness and to prevent death and, you know, morbidity and mortality.
Absolutely. I want parity for substance disorder. My listeners know I am very jealous of COVID and infectious diseases and gonorrhea and chlamydia because they get so much more attention in a systematic way. And if we did the same thing, same type of approach as we have for infectious diseases to substance use disorder, we'd be in better shape. I have a question for you, and I don't know your perspective on this, but do you see or feel there is a part of a society that wants to normalize drug use? At the same time that we want to get, you know, prevent drug use and treat drug use. Yeah. Do you feel that? And I don't know how California Bridge approaches that.
Yeah, I mean, it's complex, right? So certainly punitive measures haven't necessarily worked to turn around the overdose epidemic or the drug crisis. So I am a fan, I'd say, of education. And it's awkward in the emergency department when somebody is disclosing to me, you know, I do liken all the time, I liken opioid use disorder to diabetes, but there's a big difference. You know, opioid use disorder, that using opioids is illegal unless they're prescribed. And, you know, the patients that I'm seeing have a use disorder and are typically buying it off the street. So, you know, it's that awkwardness of it being an illegal medical problem. And that is challenging. And we know that treatment helps. And certainly, you know, incarceration has not been shown to help very, very much for this. So I would say, though I don't think normalizing drug use would be a great idea, I also haven't found that that the criminalization, you know, has been helpful. So I do think we have to innovate strategies.
You don't have to have one or the other, right? You can be like, look at cigarettes, right? We stigmatized use of tobacco, right? That's not cool. But we have compassion to someone who's addicted to nicotine. We have some treatment for you, right? So I think, and no one goes to jail for smoking cigarettes, right? So like if you have a substance disorder, you shouldn't go to jail. But that doesn't mean like, I've heard people say, well, you know what? You have your glass of wine. Why can't I have my line of cocaine at the bar? Right. There's a movement to normalize drug use, which I don't think is healthy, but I realize it's a difference of opinion.
Sure. And because there are a lot of substances out there and there's these lines drawn between alcohol, nicotine. And then there is a big difference. So I do think in this like use and misuse, there are people who do use drugs and don't use it in a way that's causing problems in their lives, right? They don't have a substance use disorder. So it's a really complex question. I truly wish we just put more funding into treatment and into resources for people because what we've done for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, that part of, you know, putting people in jail for these things didn't work. And I really just wish we had more opportunities. I've looked at other places where they had more resources, we're calling it like social emergency medicine, just more resources for the things that we see as a safety net in the emergency department. If we had more money and resources put into that, we could really change the world. So
I actually think, if you put more money into treatment, you could treat the world. If you put more money in prevention, you could prevent this in the first place, right? Like for trauma, right? If you put, you know, we invested in seat belts and car safety and road safety, and that's how we got less people dying from car accidents. We didn't do that just by establishing trauma centers who can, you know, the golden hour of trauma. That's important. But by that time, you're kind of in bad shape. We changed the world by investing in prevention. And
But I've always likened, you know, the treatment of substance use disorders. What if it was like trauma? People want to be trauma centers. You know, we have trauma clinics.
Right. Then you would have, then we would have that. Care.
Yeah.
But the trauma centers also had a lot to say because of what they were doing in primary prevention of car accidents, where we really fixed not completely. We still have people colliding, but a lot less people die because of car safety and seat belts and road safety, not because of the trauma unit. I mean, we saved some people here and there from the trauma unit, but we made a big impact. We moved the needle in motor vehicle collisions by that collaboration over many industries to prevent, you know, car crashes.
Yeah. And that primary prevention, it's so important. And there's, it's complex because it's, you know, there's not just one thing. Right. So it's an
interesting. We did it with car safety. If we wanted to, if I had it, I would invest more actually in prevention. I mean, not that treatment's not important. Of course, this is important. I'm a very proud provider. But I like to go upstream and stop this. I don't want more people who have this problem.
That makes so much sense. And if this, like I said, it's like creating that system of care, and that system of care involves primary prevention. Like, how do we work in our communities? How do we work even at higher levels than that, to your point of, you know, we had these, you know, seat belts, helmets, all of these for injury prevention that have proved so.
You know, what I learned from prevention science, it's like, okay, if you can go to your school and talk to them about fentanyl, or you could go upstream and talk to them about marijuana, or you could go upstream even more and start in fifth grade or even grade school and teach emotional resiliency, because life's hard. And when you have problems, you don't want to go for a drug. You want to go for other ways of calming yourself and teaching that type of resiliency, if you want to really go upstream. And there's a whole program that showed the evidence in this prevention science where you're able to actually go at a young age. Actually, I had, you know, one of my guests said, you know, prevention starts when you're born, you know, at birth. But there are community programs where you could invest in the community at a young age. And when you do that, you see less substance use disorder, less suicides, less violence. You know, because if you go upstream enough, it affects the common denominator for all these things are the same whole.
Yeah, that's funny that you say that, because when we're talking about, you know, I mean, if you really look at, by definition, like first age of use for people with substance use disorders is pretty young, right? Between 12 and 14.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at primary prevention, you are looking at grade school and coming up with resiliency. That's of course really important, integrating that into what we do. And, you know, we talked about societal norms and just creating, I think the biggest thing for me I'd see in that is I want there to be equity in that, right? So creating that in an equitable way would be really important. But I would love to learn more about that, because that does make a lot of sense. When I'm asked all the time about prevention, it really, we really have to look at grade school. So
if you're interested, I'll connect you with the people who do prevention science. It's a fascinating field of medicine, which is new, fairly new coming, right? And so I'm excited about that.
I mean, together, I think we can change the world here. We get prevention, like I said, the entire system of care, and it really can make such a difference. You know, it's funny when you mention that, because I think so many of us were focused initially in the beginning, when we were first starting to see a really increased overdoses. A lot of our first projects were, how can we decrease prescribing? And it makes sense, right? You turn off the faucet.
Well, we did it.
Right.
We did it.
Right? And then soaring overdoses because we didn't pair it with treating those folks at the time.
No, not because. We did both, because the supply of fentanyl is out of this world compared to the prescription opioids we were prescribing.
Certainly there is a gap, but I think that taking that more holistic approach of all of these different things that this, you know, improving, of course, we have this large amount of people who do need treatment. So we want to make sure we have treatment, recognizing that we need to also, increase education. But that prevention approach, of course, we have to pair this all together so that
yes.
we can make
yeah. Everybody has an important role. So, you know, in San Diego, I put together people, you know, from law enforcement and harm reduction. They ask each other questions. It's so cool. You know, people you'd think would be like enemies, but they're working together because we have the same common goal of saving lives. And the message is a little different to each different population, but working together, we can make a difference.
I think that's it. And that is what we did at Bridge. We just knew we all need to be on the same page. We really need to create a movement and do this in medicine, not just one person, not somebody's, you know, one person's project. We had to create this wave of change. And we've seen a lot of effects from that. You know, a lot of people who did some leadership in Bridge, now we're doing more public health leadership or really looking at kind of the broad spectrum of right. things that we can do and have a population level effect. And that's really important. But I still work in the emergency department because I also still like just treating that one person who comes in, who's suffering and scared and wants help. And then I did that last night. And then I get to have an opportunity to look at a more of a bird's eye view over what we can be doing. You know,
but also as an emergency provider, you're the canary in the coal mine. You know before anybody else what society is facing because it all comes to the ER. So it gives you, even though you're treating that one patient, you have a glimpse of what's happening in our country before anybody is. You understand the problems our society has by working there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of it, I think I used to say, why is this person coming into the emergency department? And now I realize, of course they are. You know, we're open, we're available. We provide really good medicine to people. We care, and we've prepared for them to come. So I think that I just changed my thinking, and a lot of the social issues that we face, you know, in California, across the U.S. We're busy in our emergency departments. Yes, sometimes I'm having to have my navigator go out to the waiting room, and I have to think about how to build a better system so that we can get to people quicker, so that, you know,
And so they don't need to come to the emergency department, right? You know, my husband's a dentist. We wanted people to brush their teeth so they don't need to go and get a filling, right? That's the way I see my job in the emergency department. I see what people land in the emergency department for, and I want to go upstream and prevent that. I don't want you to have to come to the ER.
Oh gosh, I know. When you bring up dentistry, I remember becoming frustrated because I saw so much dental pain. And then I just said, well, you know, if I can't change the dental system, I'm going to become better at treating dental pain. So I did some homework but I think at the same time you do that.
Do you do the blocks? System. Have you learned how to do the blocks?
Yes, dental blocks? I do blocks. Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
Zero pain. I love those patients. They're the most thankful.
Yeah. And innovating how we treat pain, of course, has also been a part of, I think, what we're doing. So I think just making those changes that benefit people, that benefit the patients that come in, and then thinking more of your community, all of that is really important. And you don't have to take it all on at once. You know, I started by just going to a meeting and just thinking about what I could do for this one problem in a different way. And I think that's transformed what I think I can do in medicine in general. And that has been good for my career in that I still enjoy seeing people. I'm not burned out, right? I still enjoy my job. And I think all of that has been helpful.
I think all the things that you do outside your work enhances it. That's what that helps burnout. It helps me, not just doing that one thing, but you're doing many different things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I want to say thank you to Chris Matthews, our wonderful emergency department charge nurse, for your question and for your service to the population of San Diego and saving lives for a living. And Ariana Campbell, thank you. I am a huge fan of the California Bridge Program. Very proud to be a participant. And I want to thank you for your passion in addiction medicine and integrating that field into the emergency department and going out and becoming a public health specialist. And also the work that you're doing makes the blessing to the memory of your sister. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor being here. Thank you. And this was a really fun conversation to have. So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. this week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors educating on the harms of marijuana. Visit isaac1.org, that's I-A-S-I-C-1.org, to view their library that translates medical journals for public understanding, listen to their speaker series, and follow the science on marijuana. High Truth producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.